Welcome to Reading the Grid, the podcast fueling your Formula One passion. Each week, we explore the stories behind books, movies, and shows that highlight the history of this dynamic sport. Buckle up for a fast-paced journey through Formula One. Now let's jump into it. This week, we dive into episodes 4 and 5 of Drive to Survive Season 7, titled Carlos Sainz and La Curse of Leclerc. With Lewis Hamilton set to join Ferrari, Carlos Sainz becomes a highly sought-after free agent, leaving him with a crucial decision to make about his future in Formula One. Two teams, Williams and Stake, are vying for his signature, creating a behind-the-scenes battle to secure his services. Sainz receives a call from an old friend, which adds another layer of intrigue to his decision-making process and introduces us to a new villain of the paddock, one who will give Christian Horner a run for his money. This episode follows Sainz's journey as he weighs his options, explores potential opportunities, navigates the complexities of the F1 driver market, and essentially holds it up for every other driver out of contract until he makes his decision.
The episode very accurately depicts that Carlos has three choices. There's Sauber, who will become Audi in 2026, which has affiliations with his father. There's Williams, where James Vowles wants the best driver he can find to replace a seat that for part of the year was occupied by Logan Sargeant, and he puts all his eggs in Carlos's basket. And very late entry into the drama is Alpine.
Netflix focuses on team representatives. For Williams, of course, it is James Vowles, the team principal who was in previous seasons of Drive to Survive. There is a representative for Sauber, Alessandro Aluni Bravi. All we know about him is that he has a background as a lawyer, and a very good lawyer, and Flavio Briatore as Alpine's advisor.
Flavio Briatore is the one who gets a villain edit and great musical cues. But he gets very light touch when it comes to his controversies, including Crashgate, during which Nelson Piquet Jr. crashed on purpose to help Fernando Alonso, who were both at Renault at the time, and Briatore was subsequently banned indefinitely from motorsport. Zak Brown and Toto Wolff are very complimentary towards him. Even Christian Horner shows enthusiasm for him being in the paddock, although he's probably happy that there's somebody else on the grid now that can take over villain duties.
Let's talk about a few of the key quotes to unpack from this episode. James Vowles, Carlos Sainz is the only driver that fits the categories of a proven race winner, true, and he's competitive against other drivers who are considered World Driver Championship material.
I think that it's very telling because, especially the second part, because it sounds like he's not saying that Carlos Sainz is world championship material, is that he's competitive against drivers who are world championship material. I thought it was actually very nuanced and very telling because publicly, all James Vowles constantly says is that he has the best lineup on the grid and Carlos Sainz is the best get. And he's not wrong because of the drivers who were available in 2024 for 2025 seasons. Sainz was definitely at the top, but he can be very overflowing with praise. So I thought it was a very nuanced quote from him.
I'm actually having to reprocess it because the way I understood it initially was Sainz is world driver championship material, competing against fellow candidates. If you really read that literally, then yes, it is nuanced saying he can compete against him, but he would not be.
It would have been easier for him to say Sainz is world championship material.
That's true.
But he doesn't. And I think, I don't know, for me, that was a little telling.
It could be. But Sainz is also not your favorite.
He's not, but
do you have bias on this one, or are you really going for a nuance?
So I think the quote is nuanced by itself without any bias. I don't have a bias against Sainz. I think it's good to be confident. I think he is extremely overconfident in his skills because I think most people would agree that he's very top tier. Like, he is up there.
Oh, definitely.
But there are definitely drivers on the grid who are better than him. And remember, he loves to say how, you know, there's really nobody better than him on the grid. And he said that in one of the quotes in Drive to Survive.
To give Sainz a little bit of credit. He was the only one who won a race in 2023 other than Max. It was very impressive how he came back after losing his appendix and winning Australia. He is a top tier driver. I think part of the challenge is if you look at this class of drivers, it is extremely competitive.
I completely agree. And I think that's one of the things that makes it exciting is that not necessarily the best driver wins. And Sainz is very smart. He's very good about calling Ferrari BS. I really wish Leclerc would do that more often. He's very good about calling his own strategy. In fact, Alex Albon in the past Australian Grand Prix gave him credit for helping him get to the high place that he did. So he has so many other qualities that will definitely help him win. It's not just pure talent. And that, I think, is the distinction. For instance, Jenson Button, who is a world champion, and some consider him getting lucky that year that he won world championship. But I remember listening to one of his interviews, and he was very good at saying that he was never the fastest, but he was always steady and consistent. I think Sainz is of that caliber where I'm not saying he can't win a world championship in the right car. He's not the driver that will set the world on fire. Because again, when Jenson Button won, we had Michael Schumacher on the grid. We had Lewis Hamilton on the grid. We had Fernando Alonso on the grid. Those actually won championship not that far off from when he did. So I'm thinking Sainz is more of that caliber.
That's fair. Let's talk about Pierre Gasly. As a driver, you want the fastest guy next to you, first to push the team forward and also to challenge you. Pierre is making a push to have Carlos join Alpine.
Pierre has the most interesting quotes that then philosophically and theoretically are great, but in practice do not work. Because remember, he famously said, "I don't understand why we can't all be friends on the grid," and yet he has a mortal enemy on the grid. With this quote, I thought it was very interesting because it makes perfect sense that you want the fastest guy on the grid to push yourself, to show yourself that you can do it. However, in practice, especially with top tier drivers, it's not a common thing. Yes, Lewis Hamilton actually made a choice to go to Ferrari and measure up to Charles Leclerc, which sets him to kind of believe in what Gasly says. However, famously, his favorite teammate is Valtteri Bottas, that he knew was never going to challenge him for the championship. For race wins here and there, sure. But overall, he knew he would be prioritizing Mercedes, and he was a great number two. I'm pretty sure Verstappen does not want anyone near his level, not that there are that many or any at this point. He doesn't want a competitive teammate either. I mean, he loved Perez because he was his perfect foil. He was initially there to protect him if he needed to hold up Lewis or something like that, but nowhere close that he had to worry about him. It's lovely for Pierre to have that mentality now, but I wonder if some of our very top tier drivers would agree with that. Like, obviously, Leclerc does not have a choice of Lewis Hamilton coming to Ferrari, but he doesn't seem to shy away from this challenge. I can only imagine if Red Bull wanted Lewis and Max's reaction.
I think it depends on where they are in their careers, too. You're always going to learn from the seasoned. And it's like tennis or any other sport. When you have someone who's better than you, or you're playing against someone better than you, you tend to level up. I think the drivers that have talent, that expect to have time in front of them, for Pierre to have a Carlos, I think he could learn a lot from him and really push him in a good way.
Well, I just think, like, for instance, Verstappen is younger than Pierre, and he definitely did not want Sainz or anyone else to, I think, really push him. I think what they really want is a fast car. And if they don't have a fast car, then yes, having a fast teammate just helps to propel the development. But once you get that fastest car, I don't think they, any of them, would want a teammate that's equal or maybe even better than them, because they want to be the ones who win. Like, right now, Lando and Oscar seems to have a very functioning, wonderful relationship.
Right.
But I think in their hearts of hearts, they kind of don't want the other one to be there, because then they can just gobble all the wins by themselves.
Well, no, I mean, they always say you always want to beat your teammate, and then you want to beat everybody else.
True, but they have well, especially Lando, sometimes have issues. And once you have the fastest car, your mentality changes. And what I'm saying is, for Pierre, it's good to say that now, and I feel he actually believes it. But I think if Alpine suddenly in 2026 is number one, I don't think he believes this as much as he did in that episode.
What did Netflix miss from this episode?
Not as much as in the previous episode, but they do fail to acknowledge that Hulkenberg was signed for Sauber. Actually, he was one of the earliest signings of 2024. As I remember it, of course, Lewis's announcement of going to Ferrari was first. But very soon afterwards, Hulkenberg was announced to be leaving Haas and joining Sauber. So it's very interesting that Netflix never got Hulkenberg to comment about Carlos. I mean, they got it from Alex Albon. Granted, it was in a press conference. And of course, Albon said that he would love for Sainz to join. They also show Pierre Gasly having conversation with Leclerc, saying that he wants Carlos Sainz to come to Alpine. And then they actually show him talking to Sainz and trying to convince him that the car is not as bad as it looks. So if they show the Alpine and Williams drivers being excited about Carlos Sainz joining their teams, why do they not show Sauber's driver being excited? I think it was a missed opportunity, although I'm not sure if Hulkenberg refused to participate or if he refused to comment on the situation.
They did not show or mention Logan Sargeant having to give up his car in Australia. We do see that Vowles lists all the damage that Sargeant subsequently inflicted on his car in two races, which they would have expected through 24 races.
It was a little hypocritical, I think, of James Vowles, because over the season, it's actually Albon's damage that topped the charts. But of course, Albon also had the results and most of the points that Williams got. So I totally get it. But I remember when the Australia switch happened, it was the most sympathy I think Logan Sargeant has ever gotten, because it was the one race he actually didn't crash, and then he still had to give up this car. I think one of the bigger or more satisfying developments that Netflix did not show is that Bruno Famin was dismissed from Alpine mid-season. If we remember from our discussion of season 6 of Drive to Survive, we focused on Famin being very dismissive of Otmar Szafnauer after he was let go in the middle of a race weekend with a c'est la vie retort. This time, he gets no mention at all, and they anonymously show Oliver Oakes, the youngest team principal on the grid, standing next to Flavio Briatore without any mention of who he is or how that switch happened. And I thought it was very poetic to happen to Bruno Famin.
Oh, for sure. Karma really came back to bite him in the butt on that one, because he was so cold and unkind to Otmar in the middle of a race weekend. That's absurd. And extremely unprofessional. So I did see it was extremely fitting that he was dismissed. I do wish they would have mentioned it in Drive to Survive and given us some behind the scenes on that. Let's talk about our superlatives from this episode.
I call it the best exchange. And that was Jack Doohan calling Carlos Sainz a paddock slut when the producer tells him that she was going to call him Prince Charming. And I just love seeing Jack's dismay at a failing to read the room and what he was supposed to say. On the one hand, it's very endearing because he's obviously just said what he thought. It reminds me a little bit of how Lando Norris in the first seasons of Drive to Survive had these types of quotes where he basically put the foot in his mouth. And I also thought it was kind of appropriate because he was wooed by everyone. And he never said, at one point, I think even Carlos admitted that he had offers from all the teams.
He did. And then I felt bad for all the drivers because they needed him to make a decision. He was holding it up.
Exactly. So I think maybe part of that moniker for Jack came because he also was hoping for Alpine seats. So he's like, you go somewhere so I can get in. The other superlative, and I can't believe it, I keep bringing him up, but he comes up sometimes with goods. It's best snarky parody, and it goes to Christian Horner. And it was very funny because he called James Vowles, James Reverend Vowles, and he reenacted how James would announce Carlos Sainz joining Williams as reciting wedding vows. And I have to say, as snarky as it was, and possibly mean-spirited, it was very funny.
This was also going to be one of mine because Christian Horner was very snarky, but he nailed it. He got it to a T. But I was also like, oh, did he really just say that about him?
And I think it was actually very appropriate because James Vowles kept comparing his wooing of signs as dating, which a lot of people kind of felt creepy about that.
That was going to be part of my other superlative. It was cringeworthy. And I think he thought he was trying to be funny when he was, it's like dating. And then you end up in a hotel room. If we could play crickets right now, I'd be
Well, then Paddock Slut fits, right?
It does fit. However, Paddock Slut stood him up at first and then made him do a little more wooing in the dating. So I don't know. That was creepy. We'll just move on from those because all of my superlatives were pretty much wrapped up in how uncomfortable it was in his trying to be humorous and his courting of sights. And it just unfortunately missed the mark. Well, how would you summarize this episode, Nina?
While it accurately portrayed Carlos Sainz's move to Williams, it lacked excitement, with no on-track action making it feel dull. The last 10 minutes picked up with Flavio Briatore's introduction, but it lacked depth beyond noting his controversial status and unexpectedly positive reception by team principal. The episode felt anticlimactic, since Sainz's biggest moment, his post-appendectomy Australian Grand Prix win, was already covered in episode one. Another highlight, his final Ferrari win in Mexico, will likely be ignored by Netflix. By focusing solely on off-track events, this episode created an unnecessary lull in a season that had very few lulls.
Now we'll get into episode five, titled Le Curse of Leclerc. This focuses on Charles Leclerc's journey to win his home Grand Prix in Monaco. Overcoming the pressure and expectations placed on him, the episode centers on Leclerc's quest to break the curse of never winning the Monaco Grand Prix, a race held in his home country. The episode dives into the build-up to the Monaco Grand Prix, highlighting the intense pressure and expectation placed on Leclerc by himself and fans. We see insights into his life before and after his Monaco triumph, providing a personal perspective on his journey.
This episode is like a mini movie. It focuses on Leclerc losing his father just on the cusp of signing of F1 contract and the subsequent harrowing moments that kept him from achieving any positive result at his home race. It all culminates in Monaco Grand Prix in 2024, which was the most boring race of that season. But the iconic win for Leclerc was one of the most emotional and gratifying races that I saw that year. Almost everything that relates to Leclerc's bad luck at Monaco has been featured in previous Drive to Survive episodes. The footage with Leclerc at home, getting a haircut from his mom, playing piano, walking Leo, has been publicly available since that race. The only new information that we get are that other drivers talking about Leclerc's curse, Leclerc's on-camera interview about his memories of his father, and that after he lied to him before his death that he had an F1 contract, his mother told him that he should not have done that. There's also Fred Vasseur's comments that Leclerc is over-motivated, whatever that means, and takes everything on himself and is the first to blame himself if something goes wrong. And finally, there's a very telling conversation with a GP, a Max Verstappen's race engineer, and Christian Horner, where a GP says that there's so much pressure on Leclerc at Monaco, and Christian Horner chimes in that he makes too many mistakes, which I have to add is his retort about any driver not named Max.
The biggest thing that they missed is Alex Jakes, who is an F1 TV commentator, his iconic commentary on Leclerc's last lap. It basically summarizes the entire episode. In fact, I would not be surprised that it was the guidepost of Netflix creating this episode. To quote, "His career was finished without the intervention of the late Jules Bianchi, who said to Ferrari, 'You've got to take this guy. You've got to make sure he gets to Formula One.' And what a gift that was to give. In 2017, Charles Leclerc lost his father, and in his final days, he told his father a white lie, that he made it to Formula One, that he'd signed the contract. It wasn't true then, but his driving has made it true now, and look what he's done with the opportunity. The grandstands he saw built as a kid growing up now rise for him, and for the first time in 93 years, this fabled race is won by one of their own. Charles Leclerc wins the Monaco Grand Prix to achieve his dream." It was so emotional watching this live because you knew what it meant. It was so difficult the previous years, watching him get on pole and then watching him go out in the formation lap to see him win this was just incredible.
I agree. And I just have to say, so I watched the Sky commentary, which was nowhere near this. It wasn't that memorable, which was too bad. As I mentioned before, it was extremely boring race. Like the first lap incident was exciting for all the wrong reasons because of the crashes. But once they started again, it was just 77 lap procession because they all changed tires after the first lap accidents. Watching for 77 laps, it was mind-numbingly boring. The only thing I could think of, oh my God, knowing that everything that happened to him, he's gonna like hit the wall, do something. It was just so nerve-wracking.
Well, especially at the end when there was a slight chance where he was managing tires, where you're like, please, Oscar, even if you could overtake him, don't overtake him. He needs to win this race. This is his race to win. And he held him off and he won. And it was phenomenal.
Actually, in my memory, it wasn't that close. I know Netflix showed like Oscar was almost gaining on him. I don't remember that being that close or that late in the race. They
No,
definitely
I remember thinking that live, do not overtake him.
All I remember is him winning. But in terms of this commentary by Alex Jakes, so I saw it later. And it, especially when some people put it to very emotional music, like if you don't have tears in your eyes after the entire commentary, I don't know what it is.
How you wouldn't cry with that commentary and him winning in general. I was tearing up when he finally won it.
It was amazing. I understand why Netflix didn't put it because it's a competitor. They've never had anything with Alex Jakes to put it on. But I just thought they definitely took it as a blueprint of how to create the episode. I just want to say that another thing that Netflix kind of missed is all the celebrations after his win, because they do show highlights and they got all the most important stuff, him on the podium with the prince and him jumping into the harbor. But everyone, all the drivers congratulating him, if they didn't show Lando being congratulated by everyone in Miami, there was even more outpouring of congratulations in Monaco, especially Max, who kept describing this race so boring he needed a pillow. But when he congratulated Leclerc, you could see it was genuine emotion. I wish Netflix would have shown that.
I'll let you do your superlatives first, since this is your favorite driver and his best win.
I call it the best support system. And that was the footage from Driver's Parade. I'm not sure it was new. It was definitely new to me. So it was Daniel Ricciardo, who was still on the grid, asking Leclerc if he's planning something big for the night. And Leclerc is demurring that he wanted to wait to see what happened. And then it was a very funny exchange with Lewis Hamilton asking for strategy tips. And he basically wanted to know if Leclerc was going to hold everyone up or run ahead. And he kept saying, well, he was standing next to Valtteri Bottas. And he's saying that we just need to know how to manage our tire strategy because I'm P7, he's P18, meaning they're probably not going to move up. That was just very wholesome and very positive exchange. Finally, there was Alex Albon saying that if Leclerc wants, he could take him to the Thai temple and get a blessing. And he says, I know a good monk. I mean, I've always liked Alex Albon, but I think this comment in this episode was my favorite from him. And also another superlatives goes to Pierre Gasly for best reaction. And this was when he and Ocon were waiting for Alpine to be introduced to the fans, and they were told that they couldn't get on the stage right away because somebody fainted when Ferrari came out. And he said, well, that's how we measure our popularity these days, not in claps.
I thought that was cute too.
That was very cute.
I'm surprised this wasn't yours, even though it's a pretty obvious one. I would give best mental race win for Leclerc finally winning the Monaco Grand Prix. I mean, it really just sums up the whole episode. I was thrilled that he finally won that one because you know how much it meant to him and his family.
Yeah, and I just want to say that when he won, everyone said, well, that's his luck for the year. Spoiler alert, when he wins more, which I'm not even sure Netflix will showcase that much, it was the icing on the cake.
Well, let's wrap up with a couple of the current silly season rumors news from the week. Ferrari Academy signed 13-year-old karting driver Noah Baglin. Papa Stroll's super yacht was stuck in the Dutch canals. You haven't seen the video. I would highly recommend it. It's a bit comical to see this super yacht taller than most of the houses that dot along the canals as well. We have also heard that Haas team principal is cautious ahead of the Japanese Grand Prix, even after having success in China. He is wary of underlying problems with the VF25. Speaking of the Japanese Grand Prix, weather is predicting a chance of rain for the race in Suzuka. We also see that Victor Martins, Formula 3 champion, joins Williams Racing Driver Academy. And finally, we would be remiss if we did not mention the confirmation where Red Bull has switched Liam Lawson and Yuki Tsunoda ahead of the Japanese Grand Prix. I heard that last year, when they were trying to make the decision between Yuki and Liam, Honda offered $10 million in addition to putting Yuki in the seat. And Red Bull said, thanks, but no thanks. We think Liam is our guy. I believe they did end up getting the $10 million for moving Yuki in, which is part of the reason why I think they made the switch ahead of time. This is the second part of what I want us to talk about. Two races, I think, is way too soon to switch a driver. I think it is really unfair. And I know they're positioning it like they're protecting Liam. I have a difficult time with that. I don't know if Red Bull at some point had too deep of a bench where they had too many drivers and they had nowhere to put them. This is such a bad look, in my opinion. It seems they have no idea what the F they're doing. How are they going to recruit other drivers? They didn't win constructors last year. They're not going to win constructors this year. You see Max and Sebastian Vettel are literally following the same career. They both won their first World Drivers Championship after the same race. Same for second, third, fourth. Then figure five, they're going for it, and they had a bad car, and then they leave for a top team the following year. Is this the downward spiral of Red Bull?
I have a lot of thoughts on this. Whether two races are enough. In general, I would say absolutely. However, nothing is black and white. And I think in this situation, it is very clear that Lawson is not ready to be in the Red Bull seat. I don't think he would have improved if you gave him more races.
I agree. And I'd say that's fair.
And I believe when they say that his confidence really plummeted. And that is the one thing he always had over a lot of drivers of his experience level, is that he was overly confident, too much, obviously, but he was always sure of himself, that he can make the difference, he can handle the pressure. And in his stints, taking over from Daniel Ricciardo in 2023 and 2024, he showed that it worked. He got points. He was not amazing, but he was not bad. And he could hold it with Yuki, even though Yuki's definitely, I think, performed a little better. In a way, I believe Red Bull, that they don't want him to completely disintegrate. However, the damage is done. Like, I don't think he'll magically go back to being the way that he was before these two races.
Hopefully, I don't know how you come back from this.
Well, it's a humbling experience, but let's remember Gasly, Albon, granted, way more races, better results, but they were booted and they picked themselves up and they made a career out of it. So there is a possibility. I mean, I don't think Lawson is as good as them, but time will show. With Yuki moving to Red Bull, I completely agree. I think it's for sure Honda. And I actually think if next race was not in Japan, they would not have made that move after two races. What I heard is that not only did they get the $10 million that Honda was putting on the table, I think Honda gave him another $10 million. So that helps with making peace that you're not going to be constructors champions. However, they do expect him to perform better. And if Yuki is in any kind of points, I think they may have a chance, because look at how many points Ferrari lost in the last two races. I don't even want to get into that. But
well, I know. I think it's like their worst start in over a decade. But
so the thing is, it's hilarious that Yuki thinks that he's going to be on the podium. But I have to say, did he hear your predictions? Because remember, you said if they made the switch, Yuki will be second. First of all, are you sticking with that?
Yeah, I'm going to stick to it. Listen, I don't think Vegas is going to back me up on this. I don't think any fantasy teams are going to be following through with their driver selections to keep this prediction. If Yuki's got the confidence that he can do it in this car, in potential rain, I'm going to hold down my prediction that he will be on the podium this weekend.
With Yuki, I think he actually had nothing to lose, because Honda and him are going their separate ways at the end of this year. I don't think Red Bull retains him in Racing Bulls after this year. So what does he have to lose? Yes, he might crash and burn, which I don't want for him, and I really, really hope doesn't happen. But even if it does, at least he tried. So
that's fair. This is his last go in F1. He'll at least say, I had success at Racing Bulls. I gave it a go. And I do hope he gets some points. I hope he has success in the remainder of the season and he can carry it out.
I do not believe Red Bull when they say they will stick with him for the remainder of the season.
I don't believe
Red Bull.
Red Bull said. No.
Yes.
It's like a carousel of drivers over there.
Right. So, by the way, my prediction of every couple of races switching may still happen. So I wasn't completely off. I think he also didn't have a choice, Yuki. That's the contract they signed, except for Max, that they can put him in whatever team they have. And I think with Honda really wanting him to be the face of Red Bull for Japanese Grand Prix, how could he say no to that? Plus, again, he's realistic of what his future holds. So the only way he can prove somebody wrong, that he still has enough in him to be in a different Formula One team, is to do something in Red Bull. And I don't think he necessarily has to be close to Max. I think he just has to be better than Lawson.
I think close to Max is so unrealistic. And I do agree. I think it's got to be better than Lawson, and he has to get a certain number of points.
Well, not necessarily in the first race, but I hope so. Again,
no, but
for
I'm
his
saying
sake.
For his sake, yes. If he can continue for the remainder of the season, let's, you know, put in air quotes, we believe Red Bull here. If he can help contribute to what, third or fourth, probably fourth in the constructors, although I think it'll be a battle between third and fourth between Ferrari and Red Bull.
Listen, at this point, if Ferrari is fourth after the next race, I'll be amazed.
Yeah. So it'll be curious to see what happens. And then because you have to remember, we're getting into the point of the year where they might stop putting money towards these cars and going towards 26. So I think there's a couple factors coming down that'll play a role.
As you mentioned, that they don't have a good stable of drivers, and now they don't have good incentives for getting drivers into their academy. They are the only team that has four spots on the grid. So if nothing else, that is the one thing they can offer. Granted, how they handle those spots is atrocious, but it's twice as many as any other team. So I think that might still hold some weight. But what kind of talent they can get in, that's a whole different question. And in terms of Yuki performing close to Max, again, I think the margins are very small. So even if he's not that far off, he could be very far off in terms of placement, and it's not necessarily his fault. One thing we know, Racing Bull's strategy is atrocious. It's on par with Ferrari, and that's saying something. So at least he's benefiting from better strategy team. That's one
good
thing
point
that he can look forward to.
That's a good point.
In terms of development, Red Bull may want to switch to working on the 2026 cars, but they also want Max in 2026. I mean, he has a contract through 2028, but as Christian Horner famously said, if somebody doesn't want to be on the team, it's just details of how they're going to get out. But if they want to secure him and make sure he stays put and doesn't do anything in 2026, I think they have to put some effort into improving this car, because the latest I heard, they're first upgrades are expected by Imola. If those upgrades doesn't change much, then of course Max is going to be unhappy. And I don't know if they can handle Max being that unhappy.
But I think Max has been unhappy for a couple years now. He was not thrilled with the whole drama, and it's going to come back into the spotlight with Christian Horner and the alleged allegations. He was not happy then. We got a preview in Drive to Survive of some of the behind the scenes that you didn't necessarily see during the race season. That's why I said I think the foreshadowing might have been 2 years too soon. And truly, if he follows Vettel's career, which I saw a comparison of the two, it's shockingly similar. I think Verstappen will be at Mercedes or Aston Martin next year. I do not see him at Red Bull, no matter how much they want to keep him.
That would be interesting to see, because I mean, I actually don't see him in Mercedes. Like, I know that's likely to happen if he's to make the switch, but just like conceptually, it's hard for me to see him there.
Well, I get it, but they have always said Mercedes was going to have a great car in 26.
They're going to have a great engine.
Well, they're going to have a great engine. Okay, fair.
Right.
Engine. They will have a great engine.
True. But remember, Verstappen won in the with the Honda engine, and Aston Martin has Honda. But engine and 2026 regulations aside, Max likes it the way that he likes it. He likes to be the most important man on the team, right? That everyone caters to. And I'm not sure that happens in Mercedes or Aston Martin to an extent, but not to as much. And I also think that he is much better driver than Vettel.
Oh,
So
hands down, yes. But I will find the post that had the side-by-side comparison. I mean, I can't remember the race off the top of my head, but literally very similar path with their driver championship and then hitting the Red Bull's got a bad car. What do you do when you're trying to chase your fifth World Drivers' Championship?
that's the thing. It's not out of the realm of possibility he still gets his fifth. And if he does, I don't think he's moving.
I don't think it's going to be at Red Bull. I do not think he is going to get his fifth World Driver Championship at Red Bull. I just
That
don't
would be
see it
great
happening.
because I think we need a new blood. But I just can't discount him right now. Like, I think it's highly unlikely, but I can't discount him.
And we're only two races in. However, I don't see him getting a fifth with Red Bull. I think he's going to have to move to a different team. So
Well,
that's
that would be
my
exciting.
right. So we're
Yeah,
talking silly season. So I mean, that's going to be what I'm sticking to this year. So we'll see how it unfolds.
with regards to episode 5, Le Cours de Leclerc, it was the best episode of the 5 reviewed so far, but it also featured very little action on the track. It was very well produced, but did not offer much new information for anyone who has followed Formula One even casually in 2024. Nevertheless, it was very enjoyable, as I am willing to relive Monaco 24 highs as many times as possible, given that this year so far has not been going that great for Leclerc. Next time, we'll uncover the papaya rules at McLaren. Whether Netflix acknowledges the term remains to be seen, which is a shame because it perfectly captures the chaos at McLaren for the 2024 season.
Thanks so much for hanging out with us. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an update.
Would also love to hear from you, whether it's your thoughts on today's episode, your suggestions for Formula One books, shows, or movies to explore, or a shout out to your favorite team representative. Connect with us on Instagram, YouTube, or X, or drop us an email at readingthegrid@gmail.com. We want your ideas to fuel this podcast, so don't be shy.
Thanks for joining us on Reading the Grid. Keep your engines running and your pages turning. Until next time.